This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Squid and the Whale, the latest film by writer-director Noah Baumbach, has just come out on DVD. He's our first guest today. Terry spoke with him last fall when The Squid and the Whale opened in theaters. Prior to that film, Noah Baumbach wrote and directed the movies Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy, and co-wrote the screenplay for The Life Aquatic, directed by Wes Anderson. His next film is another collaboration with Anderson on a stop-animation version of The Fantastic Mr. Fox, based on the story by Roald Dahl. The Squid and the Whale is based loosely on Noah Baumbach's childhood experiences when his parents divorced. His father is the writer Jonathan Baumbach. His mother, the film critic Georgia Brown. The Squid and the Whale stars Jeff Daniels as Bernard, a pretentious, self-absorbed English professor and author who is starting to feel a bit overshadowed by his wife's new writing career. It's the wife, Joan, played by Laura Linney, who has decided the marriage is over. Bernard is miserable about this, and so are the two children, 16-year-old Walt and 12-year-old Frank. The film is set in the 1980s in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, where Baumbach grew up. In this scene, the parents gather the kids for a family meeting.
Okay. Your mom and I... Okay, yeah. Mom and I are going... We're going to separate.
You're not going to be leaving either of us.
We're going to have joint custody. Frank, it's okay. I've got an elegant new house across the park.
Across the park? Is that even Brooklyn?
It's only 5 stops on the subway. It's an elegant block, the filet of the neighborhood. We'll have a ping pong table.
I don't play ping pong.
And we'll both see you equally.
How will that work?
We're splitting up the week, alternating days.
Why?
Because I love you and I want to see you as much as your mother does.
But there's 7 days.
Right.
So how will you split evenly with 7 days?
Oh, I've got you Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday, and every other Thursday.
Every other?
That's how we each have you equally.
That was your father's idea.
Don't do this.
How will I get to school?
There's a subway 4 blocks from the house. 4 or 5. No more than 6 blocks.
And what about the cat?
Cat.
We didn't discuss the cat.
Your father will pick him up on those days when you're switching houses.
I'll have to drive here 2 additional times a week.
You got a place on the other side of the park. If you got in a place near here, it wouldn't be a problem.
This neighborhood's gotten very expensive. Joan, it's very painful for me to stay in this neighborhood. You know that. Don't be difficult. I feel banished.
Oh, pickle.
So, Dad, what will happen with the cat?
We'll figure something out.
Noah Baumbach, welcome back to Fresh Air. In your movie, the parents divorce, and they want to do joint custody. And joint custody always seems like such a kind of civil, reasonable thing to do instead of fighting over custody. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the kids really don't like this idea at all because they're going to be having to go, you know, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays to one house and Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to another. And So I guess it was easy for you to see it from the kids' point of view because that's the point of view you saw the divorce from when your parents separated. Did they do joint custody with you?
They did, and that's actually my actual joint custody arrangement in the movie was the one we had. They were, as you said, they were very reasonable, rational people. They had it all figured out. And I think probably until I actually wrote it down, I didn't realize how bizarre it was.
So how did it work for you going back and forth?
I was a teenager, and I, you know, sort of also at a point in my life where, in some ways having a separate life from your parents is starting to become important to you. It's part of your own sort of sense of self and identification. So to be sort of, you know, trapped in this arrangement where I couldn't, you didn't have the power to break a night. You know, if it was more convenient for me to, I was nearer to my mother's and wanted to go there, I still had to go to my dad's. And it became, it was so incredibly rigid. So I hated it. You know, I think I was often told at the time, you know, that I had, it was actually more, you know, deeper, more painful feelings that I was probably, sort of sublimating with more this sense of annoyance, you know, in the joint custody arrangement. But in, you know, I think part of the thing I realized when I wrote the script is that actually these little irritations weren't so little. This was a big deal. It was a huge imposition, you know, on the kids. And, you know, so you know, it's something in a way I even became more attuned to as I wrote the script and then made the movie.
You grew up in a house where, you know, your parents were writers. They were intellectuals. The film is filled with the kind of problems a child would face growing up in a home like that. For example, the difficulty of developing your own opinions when your parents' opinions mm-hmm. are so strong, particularly about the arts. For example, in the movie, the father will say when talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald, "Oh, Tender is the Night, that's minor Fitzgerald." Mm-hmm. And so if anybody asks the teenage son if he's read Tender is the Night, he'll just shrug his shoulders dismissively and say, "Oh, that's minor Fitzgerald." But of course, he's never read Fitzgerald, and he has no real opinion of his own of Fitzgerald. But he knows what he's supposed to think based on what his father thinks. And it's obviously going to be very hard for him to develop a sense of intellectual independence. And that's the kind of issue I think that's not really brought up a whole lot in movies. You know, developing intellectual independence when you're around mm-hmm. strong intellectual parents. Can you talk a little bit about trying to address that in the movie?
Well, I think it is interesting, and I've found it in my life, you know, my own life, but also people I know who come from similar backgrounds. This sort of idea of opinion as definition, in a way, you know, that you kind of define yourself by what you like, you know, and so if lots of people like one thing, you know, it becomes harder to define yourself that way, because it's like, well, if everybody likes Titanic, you know, I can't be the guy who likes Titanic. You know, so you need to then pick the thing that fewer people like, you know, the thing that fewer people have seen, in a way. And so it becomes a way for you to be defined by this work of art, you know, whether it's a book or a movie or, you know, music. And I, you know, I think you're right. I think on one hand, I think growing up among intellectuals and people who are, you know, interested and sophisticated about art can be terrific. I think it's great for kids to be introduced to all these things. But I think there is that danger where you suddenly are skipping so far ahead. You know, I mean, as a kid, I used to like dismiss, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and Tom Robbins and Jack Kerouac, you know, as sort of adolescent, you know. You know, meanwhile, I was an adolescent,
right?
And so I was sort of jumping ahead to books that were more sophisticated, and in a lot of cases too sophisticated for me to even read. So it kind of left me in some ways paralyzed, and that's something I really, you know, went into with Walt in this movie, is that exact problem.
Jeff Daniels as the father, I think, does a really terrific job. Did you give him any advice about how to play this character?
Yeah. Jeff and I had a great experience with Jeff. Jeff has these kind of great sad blue eyes, and I sort of imagined, you know, if we gave him a beard sort of surrounding those eyes, it could be kind of incredible. So I told him to grow a beard, and you know, and I've been telling people I feel like the beard he grew in a way symbolizes his commitment to this character, because when he showed up, his beard was so huge and his hair was so long. It was almost, you know, out of Grizzly Man or something. And he we had to trim it back even. But, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for that character. And it's interesting because it's a character that really polarizes people. I mean, a lot of people see the movie and they're like, "Oh, the father's a bad guy. What a bad father!" And then other people really, you know, care for him and recognize his struggles and how hard it is for him. I mean, I had a Q&A in Toronto where I ended up sort of putting together this some strange sentence telling someone that unsympathetic people need our sympathy more than sympathetic people. And I was like, not exactly sure what I was saying, but I knew it meant something. But I talked to Jeff a lot about all the various sort of walls and boundaries that Bernard puts up around himself. I mean, all the sort of the talking that in a way is smokescreen. It's, you know, it's the, you know, whatever, like animal spray to kind of keep you away from them. I think Bernard is so vulnerable on some level, but he's created such a thick barrier around himself that I think he's afraid that any chink in it is going to just take him down entirely. And I think this is largely unconscious, by the way. I don't think Bernard is aware of this. But I think Bernard's ideas of success and, you know, failure are so out of whack with any kind of real success. I mean, I've seen people write about Bernard and refer to him as a failed novelist. And, you know, it's true that in the movie he doesn't have an agent and he's, you know, clearly things have been better for him, but he's still doing okay. It's not like he's, you know, in a way I feel like when they write that, they're taking Bernard on his own terms. And so I talked to Jeff a lot about that. I also think that Bernard makes, and this is, again, unconscious, but he makes people feel sorry for him. You know, I think part of the reason it's really hard to confront him, particularly for his kids, is I think that there's always something there that makes you want to protect him. And I think Joan, in a way, had to become ruthless to get away from him, you know, I mean, to break up with him. And that's what Walt is reacting to. He's very angry at his mother from his perspective, you know, being so mean to his father and, you know, rejecting him. But I think in some ways Bernard makes it impossible to sort of rationally separate from him or to even just take a break. I think he so makes you feel like you need to be there for him. And it's a very strange thing because it's, on one hand, I think he makes you feel like you need to take care of him. And on the other hand, he wants you to idolize him.
You know, we've been talking about the father in the story, but the mother, as you've written her, is very interesting. You know, she is not as self-involved as the father is and doesn't seem to have as big and complex an ego. At the same time, she's apparently very talented. She has a book that's published during the course of the movie, and her career might actually be overtaking her husband's. Mm-hmm. And she also, you know, she's having affairs. And the boys find out about this. And so there's times when you are really with her emotionally watching this movie, and other times when you feel like, oh, she shouldn't be doing this. You know, and it's, you know, it's not good for her sons. So did you find yourself on her side or ambivalent about her?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think... you know, on one hand, I did not want to judge either parent at any point, but I do think her character reveals itself, you know, in a different way than Bernard's does. I mean, Bernard in some ways is revealing himself or trying to reveal himself or actually trying not to reveal himself at every moment, but he's very present. And we in some ways learn a lot about what Joan has done or, you know, has said off camera as the movie goes. And I think... partly because, you know, she's, you know, her intentions, you know, or her motivation in some ways is, you know, a mystery to these kids. You know, I think, you know, what I like about the movie is that I think at any point that you can start to feel like, oh, this guy, I'm behind this person. I'm behind, oh, I get, you know, you identify with people. I mean, that's what it's about to some degree. Oh, I identify with them. And then suddenly they do something where you're like, oh, God. You know, I don't, you know, that behavior was unexpected in some way, but, you know, hopefully it's part of, you know, the whole package. And also in some ways, it's also more identifiable because we all act, you know, in complicated, bad and good ways all the time.
Writers and critics, like your parents or the parents in the movie, tend to really value honesty when it comes to their writing. And sometimes that requires almost a brutal honesty in which you might feel like you are betraying somebody that you love, but to capture the reality of the scene or your genuine reaction to the movie or to the book, you have to be honest, and that's part of your job. But writers who subscribe to that ethic of honesty don't necessarily enjoy being written about honestly themselves.
No, it's true.
How did your writer parents react to the portrayal of parents in your movie? Now, I mean, you are not writing about your parents. The movie is fiction, but we will all assume that to some extent it's based on the reality of your life. So what was it like for them to watch these portrayals? These not always flattering portrayals.
Well, I do think it's affectionate at the same time that, you know, certainly it's critical. And both my parents are fiction writers, so, and they've both written about their parents in fictional ways. So, you know, I think, you know, as best as you can in a situation like this, I really think they see it as a movie. And I could tell, like, you know, by their faces afterward, I mean, they really, you know, enjoyed you know, being there. And I think they're also proud of me, you know, and excited for me. You know, and I think now they could see it, you know, the first time they saw it, I'm sure there was like this sort of, you know, like you're watching a movie with your foot on the brakes, you know, like of like, you know, what's going to happen here. But I think seeing it a second time, at least they, you know, they knew what to expect to some degree and were able to kind of, you know, let go a little more. You know, but that said, I'm sure it's weird. but it is, it's a funny thing because I do believe that if I hadn't fictionalized the movie as effectively as I have, it wouldn't feel as real as it does. And a lot of people have a very kind of raw, you know, experience watching the movie, which I love. I want that to be, I want that to be what the experience is. But, you know, for me, and I think subsequently for them now at this point, the movie is almost protective. It's not raw. It's another thing. It's a movie.
You have written and directed your movies, but there's one movie that you wrote that you didn't direct that was directed by Wes Anderson, and that's The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which starred Bill Murray and Owen Wilson. And Wes Anderson produced this new movie that you wrote and directed. How did you end up in a partnership with him?
Well, our sort of professional relationship came out of our friendship, which had started in sort of the late 90s. I think we'd both initially had started hearing about each other because our first two movies, or his first movie and my first movie, Bottle Rocket being his and Kicking and Screaming being mine, came out around the same time. It was around 1995, and both underperformed brilliantly at the box office, and but they often both had very committed fans. Those who had seen it were very committed about them, and so we both heard a lot about each other. So when we met, we sort of, in some ways, felt I think some kind of kinship, and we became really great friends. And it's a funny thing sometimes to be asked about our professional relationship, like how does Wes influence you, and what have you gotten from Wes, and that's what's so enjoyable to me about it. I mean, both his work as a producer on this movie and my work as a co-writer on The Life Aquatic, it feels so much like an extension of our friendship, and so it's a nice thing.
The actor who plays the 12-year-old son in your movie has to say a lot of dirty language, bad words. And did his parents object at all to having to say that stuff in the movie?
Well, it's funny because his parents are actually friends of ours. His parents are the actors, Kevin Kline and Phoebe Cates. And my wife is Jennifer Jason Leigh, and she and Phoebe have known each other since Fast Times. So we often would have Sunday dinner. I mean, they're like family in a way. And I had, at the time, had been auditioning all these kids, and as you point out, it's a difficult role, and it's also a difficult role to audition people for, because you don't want to turn them off of their parents off of it too fast, and I was having a lot of trouble. I mean, it was a very, it's one of those parts that if you don't get it exactly right, it's trouble. And Jennifer kept saying to me, you need someone like Owen. You know, Owen has this kind of just this genuine openness, but he's so bright and he's, you know, there's something just so very natural and soulful about him. And, it was one of those things that one day or one evening at dinner, I just got the guts to ask. And they had already read the script because they were friends and I'd shown it to them. And so they knew what they were getting into. And, you know, I think it's sort of not unlike, you know, you're asking me about what my parents think and I say they're writers. I mean, I think in this case, they're actors. You know, they know all the fakery of it. And again, Owen is such a sane kind of amazing kid, and his relationship with his parents is so close and wonderful that, you know, saying those bad words and things, it wasn't like, you know, he was prepared for it. He knew them. He knew he was acting. It wasn't like, there was any danger of him, you know, running around town saying those things.
Well, I could see this really awkward situation develop where he'd say that at the dinner table or something, and his parents would have to say, you can't talk that way at the dinner table. You can only talk that way in the movies.
Right, right. It's a very rarefied conversation.
Noah Baumbach, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Noah Baumbach speaking to Terry Gross last year. His latest film, The Squid and the Whale, has just been released on DVD. It stars Jeff Daniels and Laura Linney. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.